You got to hand it to Clint Eastwood. He's had a remarkable run in the movies, nearly 70 years, and mostly really good movies. Many of the best came late in his career. Bird, Mystic River, Million Dollar Baby, Unforgiven. He's made different kinds of films, but as an actor, many of his characters have a similar kind of persona. It's that strong, silent type and mysterious. The film scholar Andrew Nelson told us this week, it's a persona Eastwood himself helped create. And the first time we really see it is in 1964, his first film with the Italian director Sergio Leone, called A Fistful of Dollars.
Fistful of Dollars is not only one of the most consequential films in Clint Eastwood's career, but one of the most important films made in the second half of the 20th century. It wasn't the first so-called spaghetti Western, Italian Western, but it was the first to break through on an international scale. And in doing so, it announced the arrival of a new star in Eastwood, and with him, a different kind of Western hero. We experience that right from the beginning when we hear Ennio Morricone's now very famous score. We've got these strange sounds and guitar. It seems very contemporary, but also rooted in some kind of tradition. And then we have this very bizarre image of the hero. We're used to in Western seeing the film begin with the hero riding out of the wilderness, down a mountain, that's Shane, out of Monument Valley, that's Ethan Edwards. Here we have a Western hero riding a donkey. The most unimposing sight possible, deliberately so. He's dressed a little bit differently. He's got jeans. He's got this weird poncho, which you've only really seen in Mexican bandit characters before this point. So all of the references are there. We've seen donkeys in Westerns. We've seen ponchos and so on, but not in this combination. And that's our introduction to the man with no name, as he came to be known. So the hero rides into town. He observes a social situation unfolding. He inserts himself into it in order to bring about a peaceful resolution.
You settle with me.
Much has been made about this character's kind of mercenary attributes, that he has no motivation. Well, he in fact does. And if you're a fan of the Western, a simple line, which he gives in the movie, where he says, essentially, once upon a time, there were people who needed help and there was no one to help them.
Why do you do this for us?
Why? I knew someone like you once, and there was no one there to help. Now get moving.
That is enough for us to understand why he's done this, because he sees a family in crisis.
Get out of here.
But along with that, he sees an opportunity for personal gain by pitting two warring families against one another. So he actually achieves multiple aims. Personal enrichment, let's say. But he also is still fulfilling the function of the traditional hero by reuniting a family together and giving them a new start in life. So he's both that old West hero that we're accustomed to seeing, but there's something new and maybe more in keeping with the times. There's a kind of, I'm looking out for myself. We want the freedom to choose how to live our lives, how to spend our money. So anticipating the direction of the culture while also being rooted in pop culture's past. The film is very stylish, amazing cinematography and framing, Eastwood standing kind of, languidly, really posed, right? Almost like a male model in a fashion shoot is how he's shot in some instances. And then you combine that with the music, which we're not accustomed to, and some other really innovative camera work. It kind of emblazons this image of Eastwood in your mind. He sticks with you, and then he comes back repeatedly, not only in more Westerns, but maybe for the rest of Eastwood's career.
Welcome to you, stranger. My name is Juan de Dios. I am the bellringer. Why are you here?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. From time to time on the show, we've turned to Andrew Nelson to talk about cinema. He's an expert on John Wayne, for example. And when we learned not so long ago Clint Eastwood is also in his wheelhouse, we asked him to come and talk about him because why not? Nelson is chair of the Film and Media Arts Department at the University of Utah.
Eastwood is a unique figure in the history of film. And I mean unique in the sense that there really is no one like him. No one has had the type of career he has, where he starts in Hollywood in the 50s, kind of in the twilight years of what we sometimes call classical Hollywood cinema. Right, that's where he gets his start. But he is still making movies both as actor and director, producer, composer today. So from the the film historian's perspective, he is a kind of link that we have between this celebrated moment in film history and the present.
He's a through line.
Well, exactly. But not only that, he's been relevant at every stage.
Yeah.
He has found a way, struggled at times, but always found a way to make work that was contemporary, that resonated with audiences. And I think that's also, unusual in that you have now 5, 6, 7 generations who have their own Eastwood, the moment where Eastwood was introduced to them. So whether that's Rowdy Yates, whether that's The Man with No Name, whether that's Dirty Harry, we all get our Eastwood. So that alone, I think, is worth looking at. But then there's just the quality of the work. It's hard to point to another film artist who has done such good work over such a long period of time. I think there's a strong case to be made that Eastwood is the greatest film artist of the past 40 or 50 years.
It's interesting that his ability to not reinvent himself, but emerge from not obscurity, but maybe mediocre, like every which way but loose when he's playing against an orangutan.
Right.
Like that was not – didn't seem like the best part of his career, but he emerges out of that time.
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly the 80s is probably the most uneven period where even a film like Pale Rider, we kind of get the sense that he's not floundering but getting close to that, looking around for different projects. A lot of the projects he's making, they're not hitting. Some of them are, forgotten today. But then, he emerges not quite Phoenix-like but close with Unforgiven.
Yeah.
And then that is the impetus to look back at some of those films that he had been making that weren't connecting with audiences. Critically acclaimed films like Bird, his Charlie Parker bio, City Heat. And you kind of recognize that even at the moments where he wasn't a success at the box office in the way he had been earlier, he was still doing interesting work and trying to evolve as an artist. And that, that is just a compelling narrative to explore.
So when we're talking about how he comes to evolve as an artist, let's talk about kind of where he begins. What do we know about his personal life that may sort of come to inform his artistic ambitions, I guess?
Yeah. Eastwood grew up during the Depression in California. He had, like a lot of people at that time, kind of an itinerant existence as a child. That meant that he didn't really develop any close friendships. So his mother has talked about how he would have imaginary friends. So maybe that's a kind of indication of a kind of a complex interior world that is below the very placid surface, let's say. So there, that indication of his imagination. Another thing he was really interested in early on was jazz. He would sneak out to jazz clubs at night as a minor and see some of the greats like Charlie Parker play. And so an interest in music is maybe another through line in his career where he is not only a fairly accomplished musician but begins composing first songs and then entire scores for his movies. So we get that sense there. But Eastwood's, very quickly the Eastwoods settle into a fairly comfortable middle class existence.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a kind of hard scrabble upbringing. It's actually quite comfortable.
It's a suburban life.
Basically, yeah. And Eastwood by most accounts is, not the best student, more interested in, sports and the ladies and pulling pranks. I think there's even some question of whether Eastwood actually graduated from high school, not that it mattered. But that's that's kind of the young Eastwood, the womanizer, the prankster, but also who has a kind of maybe complex interior life and these interests that surprise us. The music, for example.
But tall, athletic,
handsome. Yeah.
all of those things. And so I guess in some ways, maybe if you're living in California at the time, it might be just a natural outlet to say, let's see if I can be in the movies.
Let's give it a shot. Yeah. And that, I mean, not to oversimplify things, but that's sort of what happens.
Yeah.
You know, he's interested in acting. He ends up serving during the Korean War, never sees combat. He's a lifeguard at Fort Ord for the duration of the war. But it's, you know, at Fort Ord, he makes some connections to people in Hollywood because it's Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, it's Southern California. People have connections to Hollywood. And that is what ultimately gets him onto the Universal Studios lot and signed to a developmental contract.
What's happening in the film industry as Clint Eastwood starts to be interested, or they become interested in him? I mean, we're starting to move beyond the sort of the days when you would sign a contract for life, I guess, with a studio.
Yeah. So there are some important legal decisions that take place in the 30s and the 40s that, you know, transform the American film industry. And one consequence is the types of contracts that the studios would have their stars under become illegal. You know, the idea that you could lock up a star for 5 or 7 years and have a ton of control over not only their career but even their personal life. But there are still some vestiges of that in the 1930s, and that's kind of what Eastwood finds himself in. They would sign you to contracts. They would test you in some small roles. They would give you training to see if you would catch on. But even that is – that's kind of changing. So the way that you become a Hollywood star is in transition in this moment. And then there's also, you know, the rise of television as in some senses a major competitor to feature film.
And well, that's how he catches on.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. That, so, you know, after he gets, you know, dropped by Universal after, you know, failing to catch on, and there's, you know, funny criticisms about why they didn't like Eastwood, so who was muscular and tall and striking, but, you know, they didn't like, you know, the way that he squinted.
And wow.
They didn't like the way
they didn't like the way that he squinted? That's
exactly.
The best part
well,
of
exactly,
his acting.
Well, exactly, yeah. Or the way that he would deliver lines through his teeth.
Yeah.
So these things that are later Eastwood signatures
right.
are reasons why he's just, you know, he's just not male matinee idol material at this time. I mean, at this time, Tony Curtis is sort of the modern male star. So Eastwood is about as far away from that as you could possibly be. So he gets dropped from Universal, eventually finds his way back onto the CBS lot, has a meeting that doesn't amount to anything. But then as he's leaving, he's stopped in the hall by a man who looks him up and down and says, "Are you an actor?" He says, "Yes." And then shortly thereafter is introduced to Charles Marquis Warren, a very famous filmmaker and television producer who is about to launch a new Western TV show called Rawhide.
Yeah.
And he needs an attractive young star to play the kind of second hand in the show. And that ends up being Eastwood, and that character is Rowdy Yates.
What does Rowdy Yates – I know that doesn't – it's not right to say it defines his career, but it gets him started. So what is it that's happening in the shooting of Rawhide? And we'll talk about the influence of what he's seeing in directors who are directing him in that TV series later.
Yeah.
But what is it that comes of that character, Rowdy Yates? What does he learn, do we know, about that experience of acting?
Yeah. One way to answer that is he learns what he doesn't like.
Yeah.
What he doesn't want to do. I mean, he's committed to the character. He's great in the show.
He is.
But what Eastwood talks about is how the character wasn't really the type he wanted to play, that Rowdy was too good, too naive, even a little too dumb in certain instances. So it wasn't professionally satisfying or fulfilling in the way that he was hoping for, let's say. But it's still work. You know, and even figuring out what you don't want to do is sometimes just as important as figuring out what you do want to do. We all know this. So that's certainly an important part. And then the other part is, you know, being able to observe how film and TV is done.
Mm.
And the nice thing about a TV show is you have directors coming in and out, so you can get a sense of different approaches. You know, you could do it this way, but this guy did it that way. And he begins to evince this interest in the filmmaking process and thinking about directing himself one day.
So he's just observing. Not only is he doing his role, but he's also sort of seeing how this thing works. So if you have someone who has his own kind of sense of the kind of art that he wants to make, the kind of characters he wants to play, he's starting to see the possibilities, I suppose, here.
That's really well put. I think that's exactly right. So, you know, it's an opportunity that he, you know, certainly took advantage of, but always with, again, that eye to the future of, you know, what I could do next. How is this going to move me to the next thing? Mm. Not being content with playing this, you know, kind of conventional Western TV character again and again in the way that some other Western TV stars ended up being.
Andrew Nelson, he's chair of the Department of Film and Media Arts at the University of Utah, author of the book Still in the Saddle, The Hollywood Western, 1969 to 1980. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. At what point does this on-screen persona that really stays with him, when does that emerge? This, and maybe we should describe what it is. It's been described as sort of the man with no name.
Yes.
Where does it come? Does he create it? Is it created by Sergio Leone? Like, where does this come from?
That's a great question, and you know, different people would answer that differently. But I think, to me, the honest answer is it's a collaboration. The idea comes from Leone because it's in the script for a different type of character. But other aspects of the persona, you know, some of the costume, the way that the character speaks, the amount that he speaks, Eastwood famously asked for dialogue to be trimmed from the role, which may be the only instance in the history of film where an actor asked for fewer lines. You know, those are things that, that he brings to it. And in a way, that character is – it's too much to say it's the antithesis of Rowdy Yates, but it's again that idea of, you know, I know what I don't want to do, and maybe this is something that I do want to do. So between, you know, the creative vision, really genius of Sergio Leone, who has a encyclopedic knowledge of Western history, who, unlike a lot of other Italian Western filmmakers, really loves the Western and isn't setting out to destroy it, is trying to just continue it in the way that other great filmmakers had evolved the genre over the years. So it's that combination, and then it's Eastwood, and maybe there's just something about the times. The 1960s is a time of profound change, not only in the international film industry, but just in the world in general.
Is there a moment – I don't want to put you on the spot here, but can you pick a moment – from any of those Sergio Leone films starring Clint Eastwood, that they don't have to be transitional, they don't even have to be significant, but they just that just delight you.
Yeah.
Can you pick something?
You know, so the first one that comes to mind, and it's a, you know, it's a very famous moment, is when Eastwood, you know, employs a kind of makeshift bulletproof vest in the film. So this is A Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah.
So he's taken, you know, the door off of basically a cast iron stove. He's strung it around his neck. We only learn this after the fact, after he's been shot through the heart, and then he miraculously survives.
Yeah.
It's a great moment. You know, it's been endlessly parodied and repeated. It's an important plot point in the Back to the Future movies. You know, the third of which is a very reverential Western. But you know, but that moment is kind of just delightful, not unprecedented.
No.
It's not like there hadn't been bulletproof vests in the Western or cinema before, but just the way it all comes together, that, you know, the shock of seeing the hero shot and go down, but then the even greater shock of seeing him rise back up, you know, it's just an endlessly watchable moment.
What do others make of this persona, this man with no name? Pauline Kael, the director, called Eastwood a, this is how she put it, a tall, cold cod.
Yeah.
She wasn't impressed.
Yeah.
What did she see of it as just a sort of one-dimensional? How did people perceive it, I guess?
Well, some critics, one-dimensional is a good word, especially initially. But you know, increasingly, the other word we might say for Eastwood's critics deployed is fascist.
Yeah.
Especially as we move from the Westerns into the police dramas, the Dirty Harry character.
Right.
And then all of the sequels, and then some of the other types of police characters that both Eastwood played, but then, you know, other actors start playing as well. That's their take on it, that this is a kind of advocating a kind of militarism, that one man can arm himself and just go out and dispense justice as he sees fit, something along those lines. And, you know, there certainly is something to that critique. You can see where that critique is coming from, but you have to weigh that critique against the millions and millions of people who clearly had an appetite for that type of hero. And I think that makes sense in the context of, you know, the 70s. You know, this is a time where some Americans are just tired. The post-war cultural consensus has gone. A lot of the promise of the civil rights movement has not been realized. Yeah. And that comes to a head at the end of the decade with a lot of, you know, very violent confrontations. We have the war in Vietnam occupying our thoughts. So all of you know, that kind of comes to a point where many Americans are, you know, they like some of what that had been. They like the idea of personal choice, but they've seen the failure, let's say, of, you know, large government enterprises to solve society's ills. So into this moment comes a character who is disgusted with the bureaucracy and the ineffectiveness of law and order, who takes measure, you know, takes
action. And maybe the excesses of the left.
Well, sure. Yeah. You know, I think that's a fair way to look at it.
Because we'll come back around to sort of the political ideas of Clint Eastwood. Well, but I guess I'm wondering, though, is he interested in that as an ideological sort of framework for the kind of art that he wants to create? That's the persona, or that's the character he wants to play. Does that make sense?
No, that's a great question. I don't think it's, you know, we would never, you know, all art is political in some ways.
Yeah.
We recognize this. And, you know, Eastwood has been, for almost his entire career, a political figure. There's been a political component. But, you know, one continuity in Eastwood is this idea of what is an individual's responsibility to his family and to his community, right? I mean, that may sound kind of general, but I think if you think about it in the context of Eastwood's long career, he's kind of obsessed with this. And so it manifests itself in different ways. So the idea of, you know, a cop who's disgusted with what official law and order is, who takes the law into his own hands, but then, you know, ultimately the killer is let loose on a technicality. You know, that I think reflects the frustrations of a lot of Americans. I mean, we need to remember that, you know, Nixon was reelected in 72 by a massive margin, one of the biggest victories in American presidential history, which, you know, is evidence that there was this silent majority that wasn't purely Republican, that included people from all political walks of life who were just tired of some of maybe the excesses, the lawlessness, the decline, you know, the crisis of confidence that Jimmy Carter later diagnosed. So if that's the case and we see that context, it shouldn't surprise us that that Dirty Harry character in all of his complexities was appealing to people, lots of people.
Is Clint Eastwood a good actor?
Is Clint Eastwood a good actor? Yes, unequivocally. I think here a comparison to Wayne, John Wayne, might be appropriate. Not to say that they are really anything alike as actors or their approach to performance or anything like that. But I think Eastwood is an actor who, you know, even after winning the greatest accolades possible as an actor, there's still some skepticism about his capacities, abilities as a performer.
Two Oscars for acting.
Exactly. But even still, the idea that Eastwood had a persona, that he played the same character over and over again, I don't think that's true. It wasn't true with Wayne. Yes, there's a core persona. Yes, an actor should identify his strengths and play to them.
Yeah.
But, you know, Eastwood, probably more so than Wayne, was from a very early moment in his career interested in challenging popular perceptions of who he was. Hmm. So, you know, you look at 1970 is a great example. So we get Dirty Harry, which, you know, one of the most important characters to emerge in cinema in the 70s, very influential. But that same year, we've got The Beguiled, which is this really bizarre Civil War domestic drama about a wounded soldier who finds himself in basically a girls' school, right? And there's all the sexual dramas. We've got that. And then we have Eastwood's directorial debut, Play Misty for Me, which is also kind of raising questions about conventional masculinity. About, you know, what it means if you're this type of man, what kind of effect might it have on those around you? What kind of evil might you invite upon yourself if you're that type of guy? So, you know, that year to me is representative of Eastwood's interest in challenging accepted notions of, you know, either what he means as a man, what he means as a persona, and trying to evolve as an artist.
So I'm going to ditch one of my questions, which is he a better director than an actor? Because it does get us to the question of what an objectively good or great director he is.
Yeah.
When do we know that he realized he wanted to direct?
Well, there's indications that as early as Rawhide, he's starting to get a sense of wanting to direct.
Yeah.
You know, he begins to get a clear sense of what he thinks works in terms of direction that he's receiving. And that strongly influences the way that he works as a director. So he has that early inkling. And then the story is, you know, one that repeats itself throughout movie history, that, you know, an actor gets enough big hits under their belt. They've got the cachet, the leverage. They're able to convince a film studio to do something crazy, which is let this actor direct his own movie. And it happened and it works for him. And that's, you know, that's Play Misty for me. So from that moment on, he, you know, is both an actor and a director, often both at the same time.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about what kind of director then he is. Because I think, again, having been an actor, having seen the process, doesn't like to rehearse his actors, doesn't like to do line readings, doesn't want to do multiple takes. Like, what kind of a director was he?
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of words to describe Eastwood as a director would be, you know, economical and efficient. Right. And again, you can trace this back to, you know, if you as an actor don't like having to do table reads because you came and you knew your lines. If you don't like doing take after take after take because it's just the same thing over and over again, that's what he does as a director. Right? So, yeah, as you said, he expects the actors to know their lines when they show up. He doesn't do elaborate rehearsals. And at the most, he'll do, you know, 2-3 takes. That's about it. You know, doesn't say action,
right?
Famously. And there are different stories about this. Maybe it goes back to Rawhide where you couldn't yell because you didn't want to startle the horses. So you had to find other ways. So, you know, he'll famously say something like, you know, go ahead instead of action. And will say, you know, something like, that's enough of that when it comes to yelling cut. So as a kind of, you know, understated presence. But it seems to work. And, you know, we could say it works today because he's a legend and actors, great actors want to work with him. But it's really worked since Play Misty for me, this approach. And again, maybe that thematic consistency of being interested in issues of, you know, an individual's responsibility and changing ideals of masculinity. You know, he clearly knows who he is and that makes you a more efficient filmmaker.
Well, it just made me also think about the fact that composing a shot, selecting the way he wanted it to play out, understanding it as some kind of foreshadowing, knowing when to reveal a moment. Mystic River is an example of knowing when to reveal a moment but knowing when to sort of not. I mean, that seems to be the work of a good director.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, being able to tell the audience something without dialogue, without words, is one of the most important skills a filmmaker can master, but also one of the hardest. And, you know, because we know that Eastwood is so economical, we understand that he's not doing take after take after take and picking from dozens of options and then choosing the one where there's no dialogue.
Yeah.
Right? It's deliberate on his part. You know, like Mystic River, I always think of the ending of that film.
Yeah. Take me through this moment because you've described it as quintessentially Eastwood communicating information, but there's no dialogue there.
So, I mean, what the scene is, and you know, Mystic River, great film. Don't want to spoil it for anyone who didn't happen to see it. It's well worth your time. Challenging film.
Yes.
But, you know, after the drama has reached its, you know, kind of traumatic conclusion, there's a kind of denouement. There's a scene with a parade, and you've got two of the main characters on opposite sides of the street, just exchanging glances with one another. So there's these kind of two stationary figures in the sea of motion, and they look at each other. One of them's Kevin Bacon, the other is Sean Penn. You know, the way they look at each other, the gestures, it just tells you everything you need to know and kind of encapsulates what this movie had been about and what's, you know, sad about the movie. And the movie is very sad that, you know, there's just some things that will never change, maybe because they go unsaid. Mm. So it's a great example of stylistic choices completely reinforcing, you know, synergizing with the themes an artist is trying to get to.
Andrew Nelson, he's an associate professor of film and media arts at the University of Utah. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I want to ask about Outlaw Josey Wales. This was in 1976. And just because I like it.
Yeah, oh, I like it too.
One of the reasons I do is because it was shot here in Utah.
Yes.
In southern Utah. What's great about that movie? Because I find it terrific.
You know, so many things. I mean, so in one respect, it's representative of what Eastwood does in his American Westerns. There's a very good book about Eastwood called Clint Eastwood, A Cultural Production by Paul Smith, where he conceives of Eastwood having returned from Italy trying to meld his man with no name persona into classical Hollywood. So Eastwood's Westerns are famously, the ones he directs, kind of riffs on older Westerns. So High Plains Drifter is a play on High Noon.
Yeah.
The Outlaw Josey Wales is a play on The Searchers. Pale Rider is a play on Shane. And then Unforgiven is not about a specific film, but it kind of invokes the types of movies that John Wayne made toward the end of his career, the kind of the last mission of the old Western hero who has to resurrect a bit of that old savagery to save society one last time.
A play on, but he offers a twist?
I think in each case he does, because he's bringing this new Western hero, this man with no name, into them. Hmm. So you get this familiar scenario, but they kind of ask the question, you know, what would have happened if the man with no name was there instead of Marshall Will Cain in High Noon?
Right.
What if it was Eastwood instead of Alan Ladd in Shane? That's kind of the what-if game that his Westerns are playing. So The Outlaw Josey Wales is representative of his approach to Westerns in that respect. But I think in some ways it's his best Western because it's the one that offers to me the most novel spin on the familiar scenario. So, you know, The Searchers is about a man who needs to sacrifice everything in order to save the day, but in doing so is not rehabilitated in any way, has to leave at the end of the movie, in a much more traumatic fashion than the typical riding off into the sunset.
Yeah.
Right. So what happens in The Outlaw Josey Wales is you have a hero who is trying to leave society but finds himself in the company of people who need his protection.
Yeah.
And in so doing, builds a kind of a quintessentially American community of cast-offs, multicultural misfits.
Yeah.
So it's to me a very interesting counterpoint to that. And that probably provides the most, you know, innovative spin on the familiar scenario. And that's something I just love about the film. That's part of its humor, just the cast of characters and how they – and they're usually pretty conventional Western characters, right? You know, like the eccentric wise Indian.
Yes.
You know,
sassy frontier woman.
Oh, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the old – yes, exactly. The old biddy. You know, so part of the pleasure is seeing them play off of this man with no name character, and also seeing how he needs to adapt in the face of these changing circumstances. I mean, that's just, you know, one of the film's many, many delights.
I want to talk about one theme that emerges in his work, and that's revenge, because you've written about this.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you write. You write about the plot of Hang 'em High.
Yeah.
And you write something really interesting about how revenge works in Eastwood films, that it can be a thing that motivates the hero. That's part of it. But you also say that it can be understood as avenging the wrongs from earlier Westerns.
Yes.
Well, say more about that.
Yeah. The Hang 'em High example is really good. So the beginning of Hang 'em High, spoiler alert, has Eastwood's character, you know, it's a case of mistaken identity. They think he's a cattle rustler. He isn't, but he gets hung. Right. So there, the reference there is a Western from the 40s called The Oxbow Incident. And in that film, the setup is the same. Are these guys rustlers? Are they not? But that movie spends its entirety with the cowboys deliberating, what should we do? Should we hang these guys? Should we not? Henry Fonda gives, you know, an amazing performance as the, you know, the kind of the troubled cowboy at the center of all this, grappling with his conscience. And in that film, you know, the kind of the kicker at the end is they do get hung. They were innocent. And it's kind of a morality play.
Yeah.
It's the type of Western we see a lot of in the 1940s, you know, very serious,
yeah,
interested in history and morality. So in Hang 'Em High, flash forward 25 odd years, Eastwood is identified, summarily hung, but he survives.
Yeah.
And he's given a badge and he spends the movie hunting down the men who did him wrong. So if I see that as, you know, like emblematic for this play that Eastwood does with the genre's history. You know, we find out, you know, what would have happened if the man with no name was there instead. And it usually ends in a lot of death.
Yeah. Well, and it's – and in a sense, this is something else you write, that there is a – there's a commentary in his work that is on the form itself. Like, yeah. Eastwood is self-aware enough, yeah, of the form that he's playing in to create – a film that is making a commentary about the ones that came before, I guess.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, maybe because Eastwood is a, you know, is a kind of political person in some respects, there's, you know, tendencies to want to read his films politically.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that train of thought, that mode of inquiry. But I find it often overstated the degree to which Eastwood was, you know, say, really interested in commenting on the Vietnam War in the case of the outlaw Josie Wales. I think he is much more interested in film as an art that has a history. Hmm. And I would say that he recognizes, consciously or not, that the way art evolves is through a kind of balance of convention and innovation, hmm, that we acknowledge the past, see some usefulness, see some roads not taken, and then we take them in the present with a more, you know, contemporary or innovative inflection. That's the way art moves forward in history. And Eastwood has been able to do that in his own career.
I think part of what seems to be the genius of Clint Eastwood's career has been his ability to, on one hand, experiment with the form, challenge some of the old ideas, but in the same way embrace some of the old,
yes,
ideas, the accessibility that made them popular.
Yes.
And that gets us to Unforgiven. Let's remind people what that film is about. It's this reformed outlaw is agreed to do one last job.
Yep. Yeah, one last job in order to make a better life for his two children.
Right.
So he's a widower. You know, he was once a notorious outlaw. He's reformed, though, reformed by the love of a good woman. All of this happens before the movie starts. We learn about it.
Right.
Wife dies. He's struggling with his new life. And an opportunity presents itself to saddle up one last time, become that, you know, notorious killer of old. And therein the film's drama unfolds.
This is something that you write about, how among film critics and film scholars, there's this kind of debate, this question about whether Unforgiven is a traditional Western or it's a revisionist Western.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that and kind of explain the two. I guess one is white hat, black hat. Yeah. One is more complicated than that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, when I've written about Unforgiven, I've, you know, looked at what other people have said, and it's amazing to me how there's this split, this kind of divide between people who, as you said, see it as a real critical commentary on the Western and its ideology.
And the myth of violence. And,
exactly.
Yes, the hero.
All of that,
yes.
Right? But then others who, you know, see it as a traditional Western,
yeah,
where the hero comes up, he avenges his friend's death, you know, he kills the villain who is villainous because of his unjust exercise of violence, right, crossing the line that all Western villains cross, and then, you know, rides away to a better life. So we have to have these two what would seem to be opposed visions of the form, rooted in a broader idea that there was this thing called the revisionist Western that came about in the 60s. And, you know, this is something we've talked about before where I wrote a whole book about how that really isn't true.
Yeah.
Right? The Westerns have always been revising themselves. The Searchers, High Noon, those are revisionist within the context of their times. But by this point, you know, we get to 1992. That's just a framework that people use to understand the genre. And so critics begin to sort the film into one of these two boxes. And maybe in a way that reveals more about the critic and their sensibilities than it does about the film itself. But to your point, I think it speaks to one of the film's strengths, that people are able to see in the film what they want to see. It kind of confirms their vision. And you know, whether that ambiguity is the sign of truly great art or a kind of lack of direction is a conversation. But I think it exemplifies one of the best things about American cinema historically, which is a kind of ambiguity where you can appeal to a broad audience who will see something of themselves in the movie, and that will transcend political or ideological divides. I mean, American film is a commercial enterprise. You can't risk alienating large portions of your audience. So Unforgiven, I think, is a great example of that. It maybe speaks to one of Eastwood's great strengths as a filmmaker, just being able to balance convention with innovation. And if you're keen to see the innovation, the critique, the commentary, the disparaging of the myth of violence, fine, you'll see that.
Yeah.
But if you want to see a film that – and I'm probably more sympathetic to this view – ultimately says – spends a lot of time saying, the myths were wrong, only to show you in the end, oh, no, actually, this guy really did exist.
Yeah, yeah.
The Western hero of dime novels is real. And here he is to set the record straight.
Will you take us through then a scene in the film that kind of conveys this? This is the sort of one of the last scenes. The Clint Eastwood character, William Money, he's shot Gene Hackman's character, the bad guy, Little Bill Daggett.
Yeah.
In a saloon, and on one hand he isn't romanticizing what has happened, but then, as you say, on the other hand, he has.
Yeah.
Do we just take us through this scene?
Yeah, it's interesting. So Eastwood's friend Ned has been killed by the sheriff, Little Bill Daggett, played beautifully by Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
And Daggett's role for a lot of the movie is the truth teller. There's a novelist character, a kind of a dime novelist named W.W. Beauchamp, who at the start of the film is attached to one character but then attaches himself to Little Bill. And all Little Bill does is debunk all of the stories that Beauchamp has heard. Doesn't happen that way.
Yep.
The gun misfired. He was called Two Guns not because he had two guns but because of the size of one part of his anatomy. So on and so forth. And, it's in a kind of very satisfying way. Like, oh, okay, yeah, no, the myths were lies.
Yeah.
Right? And yet, at the end of the film, we have Eastwood, emerges out of a storm, right, with the driving rain. And, an important plot point in the movie is that, Little Bill is trying to build himself a house and he's a terrible carpenter and all of this rain is soaking through. So here Money emerges like the rain that Little Bill can't keep out of his house, a literal force of nature. And in the final confrontation, one of the things that Little Bill talks about does happen. The gun misfires. But rather than setting us down the path of, and this is how it really happened, it's messy, Eastwood's character, Money, quickly dispatches everybody in the saloon, right? And then has a really consequential final conversation with Little Bill Daggett, where Bill, on death's door, bleeding out, says, I don't deserve this, to die like this. I was building a house. And as Eastwood stands over him with his shotgun, he looks down and says, deserves got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. In that way, the fact that he goes back to the old traditional way at the end. Did he intend that? And does that show a complexity in the way in the mind of Clint Eastwood, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. It's well known that the script for Unforgiven was written by David Webb Peoples, in the 1970s. Peoples has talked about being influenced by Taxi Driver, and it's, very realistic, honest take on violence that really impressed him. But, this was also the time when the type of story that Unforgiven tells is very common in the Western. So it shouldn't surprise us then that this film, the script of which didn't change very much between the mid-1970s and Eastwood starting to film it in the early 1990s, is, in some ways of its moment, mm-hmm. is like one of these old John Wayne films, albeit, John Wayne via Taxi Driver or something like that. So I think Eastwood has to be aware of this. He understands that he's kind of giving the audience what they want. He's saying time and time again that you need this hero, this supposedly outmoded version of masculinity. Like, does that hero have something to learn? Yes. Can he befriend the South Asian immigrants in his neighborhood and come to their defense, white savior like whatever. Yes, he can do that. He can learn something, however problematic that may be. But ultimately, it's a bit of that old savagery, that old heroism that saves the day.
Is that his legacy, the Clint Eastwood, his work? One of the things that sometimes comes to people's mind is his sort of political inclinations,
sure.
which – some have described as conservative. He himself has described himself more as libertarian.
Yes.
There was that moment in the 2012 Republican convention, which was very strange, his
yes.
conversation with the chair. And but I guess finally, what about a body of work and even moments like that? What do they tell you about the legacy of Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, Eastwood was also famously mayor of Carmel for one term, to clean up the town. So there has been this political component. There's some association between him and Reagan, which he didn't hide.
Yeah.
He's like maybe like Schwarzenegger in that respect. He was a known supposedly right-wing figure, even if he described himself as being much more, libertarian in terms of being live and let live and in both the economic and the personal sphere.
Yeah.
He certainly was that way in the personal sphere.
Right.
Poor Sandra Locke. Anyway.
Yeah.
What I think about with that Republican National Convention moment is how immediately after it, pundits really kind of across the aisle were saying that, this is the end of Eastwood. He's tarnished his legacy and so on and so forth. When, of course, he didn't. It didn't matter. Politics is ephemeral. Art is forever. And it's that body of work that Eastwood has crafted, stretching back to the 1960s or, even back to the 50s and continuing to this day. I mean, as we're having this interview, had it not been for various strikes in Hollywood, Eastwood would have be making a movie right now.
Yeah.
It's that amazing body of work that ultimately stands the test of time. And, and maybe another thing to say about Eastwood's politics and how people responded to it, I think it's like his art in that he just doesn't care what you think. He's going to do what he's going to do, and he's going to move on to the next thing very quickly. And I don't know, as a philosophy of art making, I don't know. It's hard to beat that.
Andrew Nelson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Nelson, he's chair of the film department at the University of Utah, author of the book Still in the Saddle, The Hollywood Western, 1969 to 1980. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.